In 2017, the Mila Kunis movie Bad Moms was released in theaters.
In this day and age, it's impossible to be a good mom.
Screw it. Let's be bad moms.
I'm in. To bad mom!
You get the gist of the film from this clip from the trailer. The movie was a comedic critique of the way we judge moms in society, setting impossible expectations for what a good mom should be and shaming women as bad moms when they inevitably fall short. Beyond the movies, this trope of the bad mom, of course, has real-world consequences, and one of them is how mothers are treated in courtrooms across the country. According to the Innocence Project, quote, crimes involving female suspects tend to receive more media spotlight than similar cases involving men, especially when the accusations against them involve children. Media coverage of women suspected of harming children often weaponizes gender stereotypes, painting women as evil or bad mothers, and portraying them as having fallen short of the traditional gender roles of gentle and nurturing mothers. These biases can contribute to wrongful conviction. Now, there's been no shortage of media coverage of the Amanda Lewis trial, with much of it centered around Amanda being a supposed bad mom who was guilty of bad parenting as much as the death of her daughter. But when we look below the lid, a very different picture emerges. Hi, and welcome back to Undisclosed, Toward Justice. This is The State versus Amanda Lewis. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and author, and I'm here with my colleague, Colin Miller.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm a professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog. This is the 9th episode of our deep dive series into the trial of Amanda Lewis. Back in 2008, Amanda was convicted of the 2007 drowning death of her 7-year-old daughter, Adriana Hutto. She's been in prison ever since. Let's start with a topic we first broached back in episode 1. When Amanda was 17 years old, she had a first child named Alex. And he tragically passed away. Here's a clip covering this on 2020.
Dark whispers circulate about a suspicious past.
Adriana is not the first child that you've lost.
No.
At age 17, she gave birth to a son, Alex. Amanda's mother, Brenda, says Amanda was a young but loving mother.
It was kind of like a child raising a child, but she was excellent with him. She loved him.
At just 16 months old, Alex suddenly stopped breathing. Amanda said she had left the room while he was napping.
How long were you gone?
A matter of a few minutes.
And when you came back, what did you find?
He was laying on the floor, not moving.
The autopsy results indicate the baby died unexpectedly due to a seizure disorder. But now, having lost a second child, eyebrows were raised.
Do you think the community had an impression of Amanda that she was some kind of black widow?
I think those sentiments existed, that she was an evil person. You know, she's a terrible mother.
Would it be wrong for people to think it's an awful coincidence to have two children die in unexplained ways in such a short period of time?
Sure, it's right to be suspicious, but, you know, suspicion is not proof.
For the prosecutor, it's one more red flag against Amanda.
I call it something relevant to look at when you're looking at everything in a case.
It helped you make up your mind.
Yes.
Like other media outlets, 2020 noted the diagnosis that Alex died from a seizure disorder. But what you don't hear, and what we reported before, was that the medical examiner had another conclusion, that Alex showed no signs of trauma. And yet, you just heard Prosecutor Larry Basford say that Alex's death helped him make up his mind that Amanda was guilty of murdering Adriana. The first domino to fall on that front came from Chuck Burns, the then husband of Amanda's mother, Brenda. In the case file, we see that Chuck faxed the police the autopsy report for Alex shortly after Adriana died. And it's not too hard to read between the lines and see that he was trying to convince the police that Amanda had killed both Alex and Adriana. Now, from episode 1, you might recall that Chuck played a potentially pivotal role in this case. When the police arrived at the double-wide trailer in the wake of Adriana's drowning, they spoke to Amanda's 6-year-old son, AJ.
Do you remember what cartoon you was watching when I was there?
Yes, sir.
What one?
The Pink Panther.
And at the time, AJ said absolutely nothing about his mother drowning his sister. But then, Chuck was alone with AJ while driving him to the house that he shared with Brenda. And according to Chuck, it was during this car trip that AJ said that Amanda had drowned Adriana. Here's some coverage of this on 2020.
Burns spent 15 minutes alone with AJ, possibly pivotal minutes, driving him to his home.
I asked him, did he remember that I told him to always tell the truth? And he said, yes, Paul, Chuck. And I says, I need to know what happened. And I says, you won't get in trouble for it. He just told me that, you know, that his mother, he saw her drown Adriana. There's no doubt in my mind that he told me the truth.
Chuck met me at the door and told me that AJ had told him that Amanda had done it.
Amanda's mother, Brenda, was married to Burns at the time. They are now divorced.
What was your first thought?
I'm like, no, I don't think so. You know, someone coached him.
Do you think Pa Chuck had anything to do with this?
I would not be surprised.
But that is a very serious accusation to plant in a little boy's head.
I know. He just really wasn't very fond of Amanda.
I didn't want nothing to do with her.
Burns says he didn't like the way his stepdaughter treated her children.
She wasn't a good mother, period. She wasn't a good mother. They were hungry a lot. I mean, be dark before they'd ever eat.
The claim by Chuck that the kids were always hungry has led to tons of comments online about Amanda being a bad mom and a poor parent. And these commenters support such speculation with Amanda's admission that Adriana hadn't had a thing to eat before she drowned at about 2:30 p.m. on the day of her death. What this latter point misses is something we mentioned back in episode 2, that Adriana didn't want food in the day of her death because she was sick from eating chili cheese hamburger helper the night before.
Well, when I got home this morning, Adriana said that she had thrown up, and there was some in her bed. There was a little throw up in her bed, and she had threw up one more time. And I asked her, was her stomach hurting? Last night, we had some chili cheese hamburger helper, and I didn't know if maybe that made her sick. And she said she wasn't feeling good, but, you know, she didn't want anything to eat.
As for Pa Chuck's claim overall about the kids being hungry, we have a statement by Anna Taylor, Adriana's teacher for kindergarten. In her police statement, Anna Taylor told the police that, quote, Adriana never appeared hungry or malnourished. That's consistent with Adriana's autopsy report, which described her as, quote, well-developed and well-nourished. So did Pa Chuck lie about the kids always being hungry? And could he have coached AJ into implicating his mom in his sister's death? I asked Amanda about whether Chuck could have had a motive to make up allegations against her.
I don't really think he cared too much for me. Mm-hmm. I've always been very outspoken. Mm-hmm. I usually verbalize what's on my mind, whether I should or shouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one thing he didn't like. Mm-hmm. Later, there was a moment where he made some advances,
mm-hmm.
That most definitely was not reciprocated.
Mm-hmm.
And this was only maybe a couple of weeks prior to Adriana's accident. And I honestly feel like that was his reasoning behind doing what he did. And I do feel like that he coached and coerced mm-hmm. AJ, because a lot of the things that was said wasn't even his vocabulary. It wasn't how he talked.
Now, Chuck sending the autopsy report to the authorities wasn't the only thing that led prosecutor Larry Basford to get Amanda in his crosshairs. Here's more coverage by 2020.
Prosecutor Larry Basford was immediately disturbed by the crime scene photos.
When you looked in AJ and Adriana's room, it was just barren. And then I got to looking, and everywhere I looked, I didn't see what I was looking for.
What's that?
I was looking for toys. I said, look. You've got two children in here, 6 and 7 years old. Where's the toys? And I started looking at the other pictures in the home. Where are these children's toys?
It's tough to tell whether Larry Basford was being classist or disingenuous or possibly both. Because in the sheriff's report in the case, the following items and toys are noted. A TV with a built-in VCR in the kids' room, an Elmo doll, a Shrek Princess Fiona toy, three Littlest Pet Shop playsets, a Lightning McQueen toy car, the toy tractors that AJ and Adriana were playing with in the day of the drowning, a toy gun, the wagon that was pulled up next to the pool, two bikes, one of which was also pulled up next to the pool itself, and pool toys. And there were also two ATVs, which AJ acknowledged that Adriana and he would ride on. To me, this seemed like a solid number of toys, and Amanda agrees. Do you disagree with the characterization that there were not toys in the house or things that the kids could play with?
I do disagree. They did have toys.
And beyond the toys we mentioned, there was one final toy that I've come around to thinking might be the key to cracking this case, a Spider-Man ball. You might recall that Amanda's boyfriend, Alan Carnley, had two kids. We've told you about Alan Jr., but there was also Amber, who was in the sixth grade. At trial, she testified to AJ and Adriana playing with a Spider-Man ball by the pool.
Did you ever see her playing there at the pool?
They'd play around it.
Around it? What would they do?
They would, like, throw the ball for each other and catch it. Sometimes it would land in the pool and they'd try to get it out, but...
They would do what?
They'd try to get it out.
Okay, and how would they do that?
I'm not sure. They just...
Okay. Walk up to the pool and try to get it out?
Now, you can't hear Amber's response to this last question, but she nods her head to indicate that yes, they'd go up to the pool and try to fish it out when it fell in. What makes this interesting is that the Spider-Man ball was in the pool after Adriana was pulled from it, and that could lead to the theory that Adriana got in the wagon, tried to pull the ball out of the pool, and fell in. Here was Prosecutor Larry Basford's attempt to forestall that theory with Amber at trial.
When you said that you saw trying to get the ball out of there, was that Adriana trying to get it out or was that AJ trying to get it out?
I don't remember.
All right. If you looked at a summary of the statement that you gave the officers, do you think that might refresh your memory if you looked at something on there? Okay. Does that refresh your memory?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Who had tried to get the ball out?
AJ.
Okay.
You can see the point that Larry Basford was trying to make, that it was always AJ who had tried to get the Spider-Man ball out of the pool. But what if AJ didn't know the ball was in the pool? In that case, what might have happened if Adriana pulled the wagon to the pool to try to get it out for the very first time? Sure, there's some speculation here, but here's what AJ said when he was asked by the police about the Spider-Man ball.
You got a Spider-Man ball? Where's it at?
In the shed, but sometimes I keep it in the house. But now I can't because when I keep it in the house, I break stuff, but now the stuff ain't break.
So here you hear AJ mere hours after Adriana drowned, thinking the Spider-Man ball was in the shed. This supports the theory that AJ didn't know the ball was in the pool, which could have caused Adriana to try to get it out. And here was defense counsel following up with lead agent Mike O'Reilly on this very issue at trial.
And I asked, say, this picture, 1F, there's a ball in the pool, isn't there?
Yes, sir.
Whose Spider-Man ball was that?
I believe AJ said that was the ball.
AJ said he had a Spider-Man ball, didn't he?
Yeah.
But he said it was in the shed, didn't he? He said all his sport balls were in the shed. Did you try to find out how that Spider-Man ball got in the pool?
Never said.
Did you ask?
No, never said.
Now, as you heard in this clip, AJ also had other sports balls in the shed, which could be classified as toys or at least things for the kids to play with. But that shed next to the trailer also plays a part in maybe the biggest piece of misinformation in this case. This again comes from 2020. After playing the part where Prosecutor Larry Basford incorrectly claimed that there were no toys in the house, there was this from the show.
Amanda's story is that she'd recently taken away the children's toys to discipline them for not cleaning their rooms.
When were they going to get their toys back?
Probably within the week.
So the toys weren't gone permanently. Where were they?
They were stored in a shed.
But in these photos of the shed, there are no toys. Police are suspicious.
It might sound surprising given Amanda's response, but nope, this never happened back in 2007 and 2008. So how does that square with what Amanda said on the show? Going back to 2007 and 2008, both in her police statement and at trial, Amanda consistently claimed that she had done two things after the kids had consistently failed to clean their room, thrown out some broken toys, and taken some, but not all, of their toys to the local mission for kids in need.
Now, we've heard that maybe a short period of time before this incident happened that you took away some toys from the kids.
Yes, sir.
What happened there? Why did you take their toys away?
I had on numerous occasions a week prior to taking the toys to try to get them to clean the room, and they wouldn't, so I took their toys.
Hey, did you throw them away?
What was broken, I did throw in the trash, and what was not broken, I took to the mission in Graceville.
Okay, so you gave the toys away.
Yes, sir.
So where does this whole shed story come from? The answer is that it didn't come from Amanda, but from her boyfriend, Alan, at least indirectly. Here's how he testified at trial.
So they had just plenty of toys in their room back on August the 8th and 9th of last year.
I wouldn't say they had plenty, no, sir.
Most of the toys were taken away.
The ones that were trash were thrown away. The ones that were any good was taken to my father's closet in Graceville.
Now, there's no mention of a shed here, so what's going on? Here's what Amanda had to say when Colin spoke to her about the subject.
If I'm not mistaken, it was a few days prior, maybe a week prior. Mm-hmm. I had told them to clean their room, and they, after about an hour of arguing, they didn't. Mm-hmm. So I said, okay, it's your last chance. Either you clean it or I'm going to clean it. Right. Once again, they partially cleaned it, but what they did not clean up, I went in and bagged up, and we put it in the shed. Mm-hmm. They thought we got rid of them. Mm-hmm. But they were in the shed. And what they had cleaned up was what they got to keep. And in my mind, that was a way of trying to teach them a lesson. You know, when you're told to clean your room, it's just picking up your toys.
Right.
But I'm guessing some time period later, Alan took them to his sister's. Mm-hmm. After Adriana's accident. I don't know why. I can't explain it. So ultimately, that's where they didn't have any toys.
And I believe at trial you testified, and there might be like a multitude of different toys, that some of the toys were broken and you threw those out. And there were also some toys you took to a mission in the area. Is that correct? There sort of were different things done with different toys?
Yes. The ones that were broke, I did. I threw them away because they're broke. Mm-hmm. Some of the older ones, we took them to the mission. They kept the ones they picked up, and the other ones I bagged them up, put them in the shed.
So breaking this down, here's what happened. Amanda told the kids to clean their room after they had failed to do so on numerous occasions. They somewhat did, picking up the toys we mentioned earlier, like the Princess Fiona doll, but leaving others on the floor. As Amanda told the police and testified at trial, she threw out the broken toys that were left on the floor. And she also took some other toys from the floor to the local mission. That's all she said back in 2007 and 2008. But there were also some toys that Amanda bagged and put in the shed. She never mentioned these in her police statement or at trial. And unbeknownst to Amanda, in between the drowning and search of the property, Alan took these toys to a family member's house. Alan testified at trial that it was his father's house, while Amanda thought it was his sister's house when Colin talked to her. And the difference between the two is because Amanda didn't know that Alan had done this with the toys at all. And so when Amanda was speaking to 2020 about the toys in the shed, this is what she was referencing. But it's not something she told the police back in 2007 or the jurors in 2008. What she said was that she threw away broken toys and gave away some of the intact toys to a mission because the kids repeatedly refused to clean their room. Sticking with the topic of cleaning, here's part of a video done on the case by popular YouTuber Kendall Ray. For reference, this video has over 3 million views, and it contains her claims about the cleanliness of the trailer.
They were concerned that the kids were possibly abused, if not definitely neglected, because their house had was a complete pigsty. When the investigators went in there, it was absolutely filthy. It smelled of urine.
So is this claim about the cleanliness of the trailer true? The answer is no, at least if we're talking about the common areas. And you don't have to take our word for it. There was a video taken of the trailer that we'll post on our website and our socials. And in it, the common areas are quite clean and tidy. Of course, none of this is to say that a messy home makes a bad parent. But it's simply inaccurate to claim that the common areas were messy or in any way evidence of neglect. And you might also remember something from episode 2. The day that Adriana drowned, Amanda had worked at the nursing home from 11 p.m. to 7 a.m., attended a work meeting, and then taken a 3-hour nap when she got home. Then, after that short rest, she cleaned. Specifically, she did dishes, vacuumed, and washed a couple loads of laundry.
Is that your general recollection of the next half hour or so you're doing some cleaning around the house?
Yes. Yes, that's what I was doing that morning. I did a couple loads of laundry while I was cleaning, vacuuming, so that we could go. And they were playing outside in the front. I could see them out the window.
Right.
And as we noted in episode 2, you don't have to take Amanda's word for it. Here's what Alan Jr., the son of Amanda's boyfriend, said about the afternoon of the drowning.
And what was Amanda doing during that time?
I heard her vacuuming the living room. I heard the vacuum going.
Meanwhile, here's what AJ said about Amanda cleaning that afternoon.
Did she do any cleaning?
Washing the dishes and washing the clothes.
Malcolm Gladwell here. This season on Revisionist History, we're going back to the spring of 1988. To a town in northwest Alabama, where a man committed a crime that would spiral out of control.
35 years. That's how long Elizabeth Sennett's family waited for justice to occur. 35 long years.
Was he a good preacher?
Charismatic.
Yes, I would say.
Very charismatic.
I want to figure out why this case went on for as long as it did. Why it took so many bizarre and unsettling turns along the way, and why, despite our best efforts to resolve suffering, we all too often make suffering worse.
He would say to himself, turn to the right to the victim's family and apologize, turn to the left, tell my family I love them. So he would have this little practice, to the right, I'm sorry, to the left, I love you.
Listen to Revisionist History, The Alabama Murders, wherever you get your podcasts.
I followed up on all this by asking Amanda for her own take of the cleanliness of the trailer on the day that Adriana drowned. I mean, what was your recollection of the state of the common areas in the house on the date in question?
The best that I could with having young children and a teenager, we were always cleaning. I was always cleaning, so I don't think anybody can ever say my house was ever dirty. The kids' rooms, both of those bedrooms was just, I mean, it was what it was. But no, my house could not be vocabulary as being dirty.
This is where you might imagine Amanda's frustration with the state's claims. According to the prosecution, she slept when she got home from work, was awoken by Adriana, and then dunked Adriana twice in the pool while their trailer sat in squalor. And yet, while AJ accused Amanda of drowning Adriana right after she woke her up, he also said during his police statement that his mom was cleaning the house that afternoon while Adriana and he were playing with tractors outside. Now, in fairness, Adriana and AJ's room was quite messy, like many kids' rooms. As you recall, that was a point of tension between Amanda and the kids. And then, there was something else about the room the state used against Amanda at trial. Here's what lead agent Mike Aureli said on 2020.
Overall impression when you first walked in?
The stench of urine just about knocked you down.
It was that strong?
It was bad. That was probably the worst smelling urine room I've ever been in.
Did it seem as though these kids were neglected?
It seemed that way.
Meanwhile, here's what Amanda told Piers Morgan on his TV show Killer Women.
As far as the smell of urine, she wet the bed quite a bit. But there was also a dog in the house that urinated on everything.
Breaking that down, the dog in question was the one we mentioned in a prior episode, her boyfriend Alan's mini Doberman. And everyone agrees he had a problem peeing inside. And as Amanda noted, Adriana also had a problem wetting her bed. And indeed, the load of laundry that Amanda was doing when Adriana drowned was Adriana's sheets. Because no, this was not a smell Amanda wanted in her house and one that she let linger. It was something she was trying to address by cleaning the bedding. Returning to the 2020 episode, right after the bit about the kids' room, the show had a segment with Dr. Linda Fox. You might recall that she was the ER doctor who treated Adriana after she arrived at Bay Medical Center via helicopter.
And another red flag for police? Amanda's demeanor at the hospital. ER doctor Linda Fox describes peculiar interactions with Amanda.
When I asked her if she had any questions after I described her daughter's condition, she asked me where the vending machine was.
And then, when Fox told her the tragic news that Adriana had died.
Didn't see tears. I saw just no emotion. You tell a mother that her 7-year-old daughter died, and you expect some reaction.
Now, at the outset, it's important to note that there's been extensive research and writing about how tough it is to gauge how a person feels from their outward expression of emotion. And in fairness, in the 2020 episode, the show followed Dr. Fox's comments with this.
Family members say that was just Amanda's steely personality.
Amanda is not a cold person.
It seems almost like she's unemotional, but it's right the opposite. She doesn't display it. It's all inside. And there is no doubt in my mind that Amanda loved that child with everything that was in her.
Still, while Amanda not having much of an outward expression of emotion after being told her daughter was dead might not mean much, asking where the vending machine was when being told her daughter was clinging to life and asking if she had any questions does seem like quite the red flag. But here's the thing. Dr. Fox never testified to this at trial. Indeed, her trial testimony makes it seem like she might be mistaking her interaction with another mother for an interaction with Amanda.
Dr. Fox, after you made the decision that the life-saving efforts were unsuccessful, what did you do in regard to this child?
During any kind of resuscitative efforts, we always try to look for family to get more information, the story, medical problems, allergies, whatever. It was known that this was, a life flight in from an outlying county, and it would be a while before we got family. But after it just became obvious that there wasn't going to be anything further I could do, we called the code and I looked for family.
Now recall, on 2020, Dr. Fox said that while Adriana was still alive, she told Amanda her status and if she had any questions, followed by Amanda asking where the vending machine was. But here at trial, she testified that she couldn't talk to Adriana's parents while she was alive because Adriana had been helicoptered in from out of town. And therefore, Dr. Fox didn't find Amanda until after she had declared Adriana dead. It thus seems clear that this interaction that Dr. Fox described was with another mother. So how about the interaction that Dr. Fox described where she told Amanda that Adriana was dead? The one that was supposedly a red flag on the day of her death. Here's how Dr. Fox testified to it at trial.
Were you able to meet with any of her relatives or her mother?
I was told that it was her mother and I think it was her mother's boyfriend that was introduced to me here.
And did you tell her what you had done and that her daughter had died?
I tried to inform them as gently as possible that there was nothing else left to do. We had done everything in our best efforts and I was afraid that her daughter had died.
Okay. Now, you were the one that actually told her that her daughter had died. Is that correct?
I believe so.
And from talking with other witnesses, I understand that was an emotional time for you. I wouldn't. If you remember, ma'am, what was the mother's demeanor when you told her that?
It struck me odd because it was almost calming to me to look into her eyes, and she didn't really have much of a reaction, and it just was very flat.
Unemotional.
I remember it distinctly because I was thinking it was better that she didn't.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Fox.
And so, it's interesting how what Dr. Fox found comforting at trial was portrayed as a red flag for TV years later. Of course, all of this presupposes that Dr. Fox was actually remembering her interaction with Amanda and not some other mother. If Dr. Fox thought Amanda was the mom who asked about the vending machine while her daughter was still alive, maybe it was also the other mother who had a flat effect when told that her daughter had died. Recall that Dr. Fox testified that the mother with a flat effect was with a man, and to the best of her recollection, her boyfriend. Well, there's a big problem with this. Amanda's boyfriend Alan told the police on the day of the drowning that he didn't go to the hospital.
Did you see him out of the hospital? Did you see your body?
No, I did not go in there.
Okay.
Meanwhile, here's what Amanda told me about being taken to the hospital and told that her daughter had died.
I remember the ad litem lady for, I guess, the sheriff's department. They had her escort me after they airlifted Adrian, and they brought me back to the house. She escorted me to Bay County, to the hospital. Mm-hmm. And when we got there, they first put us in a room, I guess in the emergency department. And then that was when the doctor came in to tell me ultimately that Adriana was gone.
Right.
And so, no, Amanda was not with her boyfriend or even a man when she was told that her daughter died. She was with a woman, the ad litem from the state. So what this all means is that we can't put any weight in what Dr. Fox said because we don't even know whether she's remembering talking to the right person. On the other hand, we have what both AJ and the first responder said about Amanda's demeanor in the wake of Adriana drowning. First, you might recall how, after a lengthy objection, Sarah Campbell of the Child Protection Team testified at trial.
Now, after his sister was discovered in the swimming pool, did he describe what his mother did upon being alerted to the fact that his sister was in the pool?
He did.
Okay, and how did he describe his mother? What did he say his mother was doing?
He made a motion as if his mother threw up.
As if his mother was throwing up?
Yes, sir.
He didn't say that in words, did he?
No, sir.
Then we have the first responders, who arrived minutes after Amanda's 911 call, which you might remember sounded like this in part.
911.
I'm in the ambulance, please.
911.
I need an ambulance.
What's wrong, ma'am?
My daughter fell in the pool and she's not breathing.
Where at, ma'am?
In Esto.
Ma'am, what's your address?
3343 First Avenue South.
3343 First Avenue South.
Yes, down the road from the post office at the very end.
What's your phone number, ma'am?
850-263-0759.
And she's not breathing. How old is she?
She's 7 years old.
All right, hang on just a second, ma'am.
Oh, God.
Just a second, ma'am.
Her lips are purple. What do I do?
Here's what Chief Charles Corcoran testified to on cross-examination.
Chief, when you first drove up there, you said that the mother was kneeling over the child. Could you describe what emotional state she was in when we arrived?
Distraught, sobbing, and weeping, and crying.
And then there was first responder Jose Martinez.
Okay, the baby was here. The mother was on her knees, on between the baby, on this position,
right,
as she was crying.
Okay.
Then there was first responder Gary Jacobs.
How was she acting that day when you drove up there?
Well, you ran over a little girl, and she was trembling, and I guess more or less, and I guess you'd say shock or something like that.
Was she upset?
She was upset, yes, sir.
Was she crying?
I didn't see her face. I don't know if she was crying or not exactly. I can't say that.
All of this testimony points in the same direction, that Amanda was distraught after the death of her daughter. And that sets up another wrinkle in this case that almost nobody knows. You certainly wouldn't get this from the coverage of the case, but the state's theory was not that Amanda intentionally killed Adriana. Instead, the state's theory of the case was that after being awoken by Adriana, and with other punishments having not worked, Amanda dunked Adriana to try to get her to behave. Here's Prosecutor Larry Basford setting some of this up in his closing argument.
Now, remember this. This is a woman who'd had to work the night shift just the prior night. And this is a woman who'd worked that night an extra long shift till the next day, extra hour because they had that in-service training. This is a woman that was trying to get some sleep. But she couldn't that day because Adriana was not on her medication. Adriana was not staying in a room. In fact, she was in slamming cabinets and spraying stuff. This is a woman who was tired. This is a woman who was frustrated. This is a woman who had tried all types of discipline to get Adriana to mind. She had tried grounding her. She had tried taking away her toys. She had tried spanking her. But this time, she was going to try something different to get her attention. She was going to dunk her in that pool. If you do that one more time, I'll dunk you in the pool. This is the ultimate punishment. She knew how afraid Adriana was of water.
And then later, Larry Basford made clear that he was not arguing and the jury did not need to find that Amanda was trying to kill her daughter.
Then what happened? The defendant went inside and decided after she had calmed down, because I'm going to submit to you, ladies and gentlemen, this is not a case where when the defendant took little Adriana out to the pool the second time, she intended to kill that little girl. That is not what we're saying. But I am telling you, she did intend to punish her, to maliciously punish her. And that's what she did. In this case, she went too far. That's the reason we're not here on just an aggravated child abuse case. We're here on a first-degree felony murder case, because this was malicious punishment. This was child abuse that resulted in great bodily harm, that being death.
If all this sounds confusing, that's because it is. Specifically, Amanda was found guilty of felony murder based upon Adriana dying during Amanda's commission of felony child abuse. In most states, this theory wouldn't work. The theory of felony murder is that someone with what's called a, quote, separate felonious intent has someone die as a result of actions that are foreseeably dangerous to human life. For example, someone commits felony arson by burning their failing rental property and ends up killing a squatter. Or someone commits felony burglary with a homeowner dying as they fall down the stairs when trying to confront the intruder. But most states have what's known as the merger doctrine for crimes against a person. For example, imagine that a defendant punches a victim in the nose in a bar fight, with the victim then stumbling backwards, slipping on spilled beer, falling, breaking their neck, and dying. That defendant is guilty of felony battery. But based upon that alone, are they also guilty of felony murder? Most states say no, because there's no separate felonious intent. If you want to say this was straight up murder, fine. But to say that battery is murder just because the victim ended up dying would defeat the distinction between the two crimes. The same should have applied to Amanda's case. If the jury found that Amanda maliciously drowned her daughter, they could have found her guilty of straight murder. But they weren't asked to do that. They were just asked to decide whether Amanda abused Adriana by dunking her, with that alone allowing them to find her guilty of murder, even though the prosecutor made clear there was no intent to kill. This was the basis for Amanda's appeal that was decided back in 2010. She claimed the merger doctrine meant that she couldn't be found guilty of murder. And as support, she cited a 2005 case called Brooks, decided by the state Supreme Court. In Brooks, Florida's highest court found that felony child abuse cannot be the basis for a felony murder conviction based upon the merger doctrine. But for those of you who haven't been to law school, there's a term called dicta. It refers to the portion of an opinion that was not necessary to the court's ruling. In other words, it's like idle chatter rather than the heart of a conversation. According to the court in Amanda's case, this portion of the Brooks opinion was dicta, and Florida's felony murder statute got rid of the merger doctrine, meaning that Amanda could be convicted of murder. And indeed, just a few years later, the Florida Supreme Court agreed, finding felony murder can come from a crime against a person. That's a lot of legalese, but here are the two key take-homes. One, in most states, Amanda could not have been convicted of murder based upon the state's theory of the case. And two, the jury did not find, and was not asked to find, that Amanda was trying to kill her daughter. Indeed, they were told the opposite.
That said, at one point in the trial, the prosecution very much did want the jurors to believe that Amanda wanted her daughter dead. This dealt with an incident at Amanda's job at a nursing center. Here was testimony by her supervisor, Takshira Dossi.
Is there one morning in particular that stands out in your mind when the defendant brought her children to school?
It was one particular morning. She came in.
Would you tell us about it?
She came in and she was very upset, very irate. And we said, what's wrong, Amanda? She said, I'm just going to kill him. I'm going to kill her. And I was like, don't say that. And I asked her to come go with me. And Adriana got up in Kim's lap and sat. And I took it, Amanda into the pantry and talked to her.
Okay. What did you counsel her about? Well, first of all, why did you do that?
Because she was upset, and that was the beginning of the day. Not only was she dealing with her children, but she was going to be dealing with the residents there.
And you were one of her supervisors?
And I was the supervisor. I was in charge of the unit to ensure that the unit ran smoothly. That was my job.
So did you counsel with her?
Yes, I took her into the pantry and I told her, I said, Amanda, a lot of times we say things that we don't mean and that we don't mean to say, especially to our children. And so once we talked and we got into the conversation, I said, can we pray? And we began to pray. And once we prayed about it, she calmed down.
Meanwhile, here was Amanda's explanation of what happened when she was interviewed by Piers Morgan for Killer Women.
She wrote throughout my car with a permanent marker.
What did she write?
Loser. And I don't even know where she got the word from.
One of your colleagues at the care center remembered you saying you were so annoyed about Adriana's behavior one day. You said, oh, I want to kill her. Now, given what happened, people could put two and two together and think, well, there we are.
I did not say I wanted to kill her. I said, oh my goodness, I could have just killed her.
About the car.
And here's what she said on 2020.
When you heard that in court, what did you think?
It was made to be so much more than what it was.
But you didn't mean that?
No, never.
Just an expression?
Just an expression. I mean, that's a comment that everybody uses. But never in my mind ever would I ever do that to either one of my children.
Now, notably, Amanda's supervisor did not speak to a course of conduct of Amanda being mad at Adriana, let alone furious. Indeed, among many times seeing Amanda with her kids at work, this was the only time that stood out as being bad.
Now, you saw her on other occasions with the children up there at the nursing center, right?
Yes, I did.
Okay. But that is the one that sticks out in your mind.
It was. It was other times, you know, but that was the one particular time that she was very upset that morning.
But the prosecution tried to blow up this incident to paint Amanda with a broad brush as a bad mom, and specifically a bad mother who didn't love her daughter. Here was some testimony by Amanda's co-worker, Kimberly Smith, who testified to the marker incident as well as this.
Did you ever talk about bonding on any of those occasions?
Yes, sir.
Tell us about those discussions, ma'am.
She had talked to us about the fact that she didn't have a chance to bond with Adriana. I guess like the first 6 months of Adriana's life, she was in the military. She said she never was able to develop that bond and that she just didn't love her like she should and she didn't know how to. We tried to encourage her, give her ideas or whatever.
This then became a centerpiece of the state's case, that Adriana died due to Amanda not loving her. Indeed, here was the very last thing Prosecutor Larry Basford told the jurors in his opening statement.
The defendant was a mother, but she was also tired. She was also frustrated. And when she went out there that day to punish or to discipline her child, her emotions got the better of her that day. You will hear that she never thought she bonded with this child. She talked to her workers and family and knew that she didn't love her like she should. And that day, something snapped. That's what led to the death of Adriana Elaine Hutto. Thank you for your attention.
And there was one particular way in which Larry Basford tried to claim that Amanda didn't care about her daughter and had given up on her. This was the lack of books in the trailer. Throughout trial, Basford would keep trying to bring this up, even when it had nothing to do with the witness's testimony. For example, after lead agent Michael Raley had testified about taking photos of the pool and wagon, here was an attempted exchange between Basford and him.
You saw some photographs earlier there, sir, of Adrian's bedroom?
Yes, sir.
Did you see any books in that bedroom that day, sir?
I saw his books, right, guys.
Withdraw the question, Judge.
You get the gist. Basford was trying to paint the picture of Amanda as a bad mom who never bonded with her daughter and had given up on her and her education. So how did Amanda herself say she felt about her daughter? Here's what she told 2020.
And Amanda admits she had trouble bonding with Adriana. She was part of the National Guard, and when Adriana was just 6 months old, Amanda was called up for duty. She left Adriana in the care of her family for months. But she says her affection for Adriana developed over time.
I wanted to protect her and keep harm away from her.
Did you love Adriana?
Very much.
And here's what she told Colin on the topic.
After I had her, that's, I left to go to basic training. And then when I come back, she was, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, around 6 months old.
Right. So in other words, you have her, and then in those first six months, you have to immediately do basic training for 6 months.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I have to deploy back out. And then when I came back, you know, she was older, and that time period of her bonding, she bonded with my mom.
Mm-hmm.
So then when I come back, it's like I'm a stranger coming in to take over, which it wasn't bad.
Mm-hmm.
The only part that I do regret is I did have to leave.
Right.
That early. And I didn't get to have that bond with her that she ultimately wound up having with my mom because she took care of her.
Right.
So when I come back, it was like I had to form my own bond with her. And, you know, sometimes I was kind of resentful because she had it with my mom and I wanted it with her.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we ultimately, I feel like we formed our own bond. It might not have been as strong, but we formed one.
Right. And I think I've heard you describe Adriana as sort of a miniature version of yourself in terms of her mannerisms, the way she acted, et cetera. Is that accurate that that's the way you saw her, as sort of a miniature version of yourself?
Yes. Most definitely.
Yeah.
both stubborn, both hard-headed, mm-hmm. Both outspoken with our opinions, attitudes, all the way down to our feet, the way we stood. It was just replica right. in every way.
And then what about the theory that Amanda had given up on Adriana and her education? Well, recall the incident where Amanda was with her kids at work after the permanent marker incident. Amanda had taken that specific job and was there with her kids specifically because it allowed her to drop off and pick up her kids from school. Again, here was testimony by her coworker, Kimberly Smith.
Was it a common practice with some of the nurses or CNAs there at the nursing center to bring their children to work with them in the mornings?
Yes, sir.
Okay, and why is that, ma'am?
We brought them up there and we put them on the bus. We brought them to the bus stop in the morning.
All right. And then by the time school was out, the shift was almost over. And
yes, sir.
Get the children and be ready to go home, or yes, they could sir. Stay till the end of the shift.
Yes, sir.
I gather you might have done that on occasions yourself.
Yes, sir. Mine every morning and every afternoon.
This then takes us to testimony by Robin Mercer, Adriana's teacher for the most recent school year that ended just months before she died.
Did you have a student in your class named Adriana Hutto?
Yes, I did.
Do you remember her?
Oh, yes.
What can you tell us about Adriana?
She was a beautiful little girl. I loved her very much. She just had a beautiful smile, and she got along well with the kids, and I just loved her.
Defense counsel then took Robin Mercer through how Adriana did in school and how active Amanda was in her education.
Did you have any contact with her mother, Amanda
yes.
Lewis?
Yes, I did.
Do you see Miss Lewis in the courtroom?
Yes.
Was Miss Lewis involved in her child's progress there at the school?
Yes, she was.
Would you call her and talk to her?
Yes, and if I had any problems, she would call me back. She seemed like a very concerned parent.
Okay. And what would happen if Adriana had a bad day and wet her pants? What would happen?
She actually came to the school and picked her up the day that she did wet her pants. It was later in the afternoon, so really there was no need for her to come back to school. It was, I would say, 1:30 in the afternoon, and we get dismissed about 2:30, 2:45.
Did Adriana make progress through the first grade?
Oh, yes. She was a very bright student. And she had a lot of potential. She loved to read.
She loved to read?
She loved to read. Anytime we had any free time, she would read. She loved books.
About how many times do you think you talked with her mother, had either over the telephone or talked to her face-to-face about Adriana?
I would say probably 10 to 12 times. We have mid-year conferences, and she came for the mid-year conference, and we have that with every child to discuss their behavior, their academics, and just basically their progress in first grade and how well they'll do in second grade, and she came for that. She came for awards day. She came to eat with her child from time to time.
And basically, Adriana was sort of a normal first grader then.
She was.
And then you might recall Chuck Burns, the husband of Amanda's mother, claiming that the kids were neglected and that Amanda was a bad mom who was raising them poorly. Well, Robin Mercer painted a very different picture.
Did you, when she came to school, was she on time, or was she one of those kids that's always late? Or?
No, she always came on time. We never had any problem with excessive absences.
Was she dressed appropriately?
Very. She loved wearing dresses and skirts. And one thing I can remember about her is first thing in the morning, she would come to my classroom just to show me what she had on for that day. And she loved to have her hair done in different ways, and she would show me, and I would always joke around with her, telling her that I would want what she had on, and it just seemed to make her feel good about herself, but she was a beautiful little girl.
Now as a teacher, are you all educated or schooled to look for signs of abuse?
Yes, we are.
Your children, and did you ever detect any signs of abuse?
I never saw any bruises. She seemed very happy, and we talked every day. Graceville Elementary is a very small school, and I don't have a big class. I had a very small class, so we were very close. All my students and myself were very close, and she loved her brother. She talked about her mother. in high regard.
Okay. And you never had any concerns about her being abused or not being taken care of? Or...
No, I did not.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Colin followed up on this by asking Amanda why she took such an active role in her daughter's education.
Robin Mercer, who is Adriana's teacher in the most recent school year, testified for the defense at trial, and she testified that Adriana was doing well. She was always well-dressed, liked to come in at the start of school and show off her clothes to her teacher, said she was doing well in school, and said you were a very concerned parent, that you would come in and have lunch with Adriana at school sometimes, that you always appeared and came for parent-teacher conferences. And I think she said you spoke on the phone maybe 10 to 12 times during the school year to check in and see how Adriana was doing. And so why and how is it so important to you to have that contact with her teacher regarding her progress in school?
I think because, and I don't want anybody to take this wrong, because my mom was awesome in a lot of different ways, but in some ways I felt like I wanted to do it. I wanted to give her better than what I had.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously her dad didn't want to be around, so I felt like I had to be both parents.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't want her or AJ to be neglected in any way as far as me being there for them.
Mm-hmm.
So I went over and beyond. Maybe some people might say too much, but it's just what I felt like I had to do.
In the end, none of Amanda's efforts mattered. She was painted in the press and at trial as the ultimate bad mom who had two kids die under her watch. And all of this led to Amanda being convicted of murder and being given a life sentence without parole. But this almost never happened. Amanda was asked to take a polygraph, then a plea deal. And then she was asked to make a decision to face the death penalty or to have her jury cut in half. Next time on Undisclosed.
Hey, Undisclosed listeners, it's Meethal, executive producer of Undisclosed Toward Justice. As you know, we did something new a few months ago by utilizing SpeakPipe as a way for you guys to leave us voice notes. For anyone new here, you can go to speakpipe.com/undisclosed to leave us your questions or thoughts and comments. Since the response to SpeakPipe has been so amazing, we've got two additional exciting announcements to make. First, we have a new Facebook community group where you can engage with us and one another about all things true crime and criminal justice. Just go to facebook.com/groups/towardjustice and answer three simple questions, and you're in. In addition to that, we also just relaunched our Patreon page at patreon.com/undisclosedpod. So many folks have already signed up, and we can't express our gratitude enough to each and every single one of you. Even a dollar goes a long way and allows us to do the work pro bono for our defendants. Also, I would like to give a quick shout out to Hannah McCarthy for audio production, as well as Patrick Cortez and Ramiro Marquez for our theme music. To engage with us on social media, we're on Instagram and Facebook at Undisclosed Podcast. You can find us on TikTok, YouTube, and X at Undisclosed Pod. Whether you're new or a returning listener, you can check out our previous cases and bonus episodes by going to our revamped website at undisclosedpod.com. If you would like to follow Colin and Rabia on social media, you can follow Rabia at Rabia2, the number 2, on Instagram, and Colin at EvidenceProf on Instagram, X, and Blue Sky. Thank you for your continued support for us and for supporting our sponsors. Until next time.